This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
At some point, concessions end, and they've ended here today.
I have no choice but to announce the formal cancellation of play for 2004-2005.
On Wednesday, Bob Goodenow, executive director of the National Hockey League Players Association, maintained that the players had gone as far as they could go. Gary Bettman, the commissioner of the National Hockey League, announced that the season, which never began, was over. And then last night, the Hockey News reported that the two sides had agreed in principle to a deal that would involve a $45 million per team salary cap, and that the representatives of the players and the owners would meet today in New York to finish negotiations, which might very well enable the National Hockey League to stage a season. It was, to say the least, an odd turn of events, given the way union head Bob Goodenow had characterized the negotiations just a little more than 48 hours earlier.
Every offer by the players moved in the owner's direction. Players never tried to improve their position or keep the old CBA. The players sincerely wanted a fair deal and pushed hard to get one. Unfortunately, we never had a real negotiating partner.
Mr. Goodenow was referring to his side's willingness to accept the salary cap, something the players had refused to consider until last weekend. The union's concession came as the owners offered to abandon their plan to link player compensation to league revenues. But when he canceled the season, Commissioner Bettman also announced a change in his strategy.
That offer is off the table, and we have to, by necessity, be back at linkage because nobody knows what the damage to the sport will be. And so we're going to have to look at a completely different economic model, and it is going to have linkage. The best deal that was on the table is now gone.
Apparently, some deal similar to that best one must have reappeared, or there would be no reason for the two sides to reconvene in New York today. Hockey fans will be watching for news from those meetings, as will fans of melodrama, comedy, and farce, and we'll have more on this story a little later on in the program. But first, let's turn to a sport still gleefully creating goodwill and profits. The NBA All-Star Game will take place tomorrow. Joining me now to discuss that glittering event and to anticipate the second half of the pro hoops season is Mary Schmidt-Boyer, who writes about the NBA for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Mary, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me again.
Mary, he may be only 20 years old, he may be in his first All-Star Game, but there is a sense that this weekend will be a coronation of sorts for LeBron James of your Cleveland Cavaliers. You agree?
I do agree. I think this will likely be the first of many All-Star appearances by LeBron. You know, I covered the Cavs when there was nobody in the arena and you could hear a pin drop and people used to talk about all those empty blue seats that showed up on television. And there's an actual pulse in the arena. You can feel when people come in, there's a buzz. It is just so incredibly different from 2 years ago.
What else should we expect to see in Denver this weekend besides the obvious no defense? Are you looking forward to anything else in particular?
Honestly, no. There are so many of these, you know, the rookie sophomore game, the slam dunk they could have done away with years ago for my money. They did actually do it away with it for a while.
Then they brought it back.
I'm not sure why they brought it back.
Well, my friend Charlie Pierce says, what's dull about watching guys fly?
Well, to me, as a writer, you know, he dunked the ball, and then he dunked the ball, and, you know, he went behind his head and dunked the ball. It's just, I love and respect Charlie. I'm not with him on that one.
Well, once play resumes next week, the Phoenix Suns will continue to vie for the league's best record. They employ a quaint tactic called the fast break. Wasn't that supposed to have gone the way of knee socks, tight shorts, and the Jack Sigma mullet perm years ago?
People think, however, that it might not work in the postseason. But I love watching them. I think most people who sort of grew up watching the NBA, this is the real NBA to them.
The Suns are one of seven teams averaging over 100 points a game this season, compared to only two doing that at this point last year. Are more teams going to embrace the high-scoring style, the playoff worry notwithstanding?
You know, I would think when you look at Phoenix, how could people argue with those results? Now, of course, every team isn't going to have Steve Nash, but I think that certainly more teams would at least like to try to bring a running game back into the NBA, and I'm sure the powers that be in the NBA would be only too happy to have those scores keep going up.
The Seattle Supersonics have surprised a lot of people this year. They lead their division by 10 games. How has a team that didn't even make the playoffs last year turned things around so quickly?
They are a surprise. I don't know why all of a sudden some things click. Conversely, I saw the Minnesota Timberwolves recently, and there's a team you can't figure out what happened to them in the reverse. Mm. You know, they were, looked like title. They were title contenders last year, and they have essentially the same team and have already fired their coach. And, you know, I don't know why some things work one year and the same cast of characters can't produce the same results the next year.
In Miami, the duo of center Shaquille O'Neal and second-year guard Dwayne Wade were not supposed to be this good this soon, but it looks as if the Heat may be the class of the Eastern Conference. We got a lock for the finals there?
Well, I see nobody in the Eastern Conference who can do anything with Shaq. Boy, I don't see anybody in the East threatening them. Of course, you know, we never saw the Detroit Pistons upending Shaq and the Lakers last year either.
Meanwhile, Kobe Bryant, who always wanted to be the man for the Los Angeles Lakers during their title runs, is now the leader of, oops, an average team that may not even make the playoffs.
Exactly.
Do you think he wishes that O'Neal and former coach Phil Jackson were around to lend a hand?
Honestly, I do not. I don't know Kobe very well, you know, just have covered him from afar. But everything that I have read or heard about him would seem to indicate, no, that he doesn't regret anything. Recently, when Karl Malone retired, someone asked him about, you know, are you sorry that, you know, one of the last things Karl Malone will be remembered for is, you know, the spat with you and over this supposed pass at Kobe Bryant's wife. And he said, you know, that didn't have anything to do with him retiring. So as anybody with a child around that age knows, they pretty much think they're never wrong. So I think I would put Kobe in that category.
Finally, Mary, in response to the drunken riot that occurred in Detroit earlier this season, the NBA announced a new alcohol policy under which fans can no longer buy more than two beers at once or any beer after the third quarter. The policy also limits the size of the beer to 24 ounces. How big were the beers before the new policy?
I don't know, but I wish I had a few before they changed it. My goodness. The funny thing is, here in Cleveland, these are exactly the same policies that the Browns instituted, and I have to say it affected drunkenness at their games not at all. So
yeah, everything changed right away, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe people just have more to drink now when they come in.
Mary Schmidt-Boyer covers the NBA for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Mary, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much. Happy All-Star Weekend.
While Shaq, LeBron, Zydrunas, Yao, Manu, Amari et al. Play in tomorrow's All-Star Game, the uninvited NBA players will be left to their own devices. From Seattle, John Moe reports on how some will keep busy during the All-Star break.
The locker rooms before a recent Seattle Supersonics-Dallas Mavericks game are like all locker rooms at this point in the NBA season. Ice packs, long lines at the trainer's table, foot baths, and therapeutic massages. Everyone's beat up. Mavericks center Sean Bradley, an 11-year veteran but never an all-star, welcomes the chance to rest this weekend.
I'm spending time with my lovely wife. I mean, I'm excited about it. It's something we look forward to every year. But you have to maintain, you know, your level of fitness, too. So you got to make sure you're doing something during that time, because 4 or 5 days is a long time to do nothing, especially at this level.
Avery Johnson is in his first year as a Mavericks assistant coach after wrapping up a 16-year playing career. He says coaches don't exactly get to lay around in a hammock either.
I think as a coach, you tend to want to watch film more, do a lot more evaluation of the team. I think as a player, you probably did it a little bit more cerebral and really concentrated on resting your body. Whereas I don't have to rest my body, I actually need to work out more and watch some film. So it changes a little bit.
You need a few days to rest your mind?
Not really. Maybe a day. Yeah. But after that, my mind is programmed right now to keep going. So I don't think I need a day to rest my mind.
Sonics guard Antonio Daniels says playing skills can slip in a hurry, even for elite athletes. So he's planning to stay busy over the break at his off-season home in San Antonio.
I work out every damn near. I go shoot every damn near. I go run every damn near. So that way when, you know, you start up the second half of the season, so to speak, you're not rusty. You know, you're not just starting all the way over and using that practice to get back in shape or to get your rhythm back. So hopefully, you know, I'll continue to do a lot of the same things I'm doing now just so I don't lose my rhythm.
Do you get rusty after only 5 days?
5 days is a long time off when you practice every day. You know, that's a long time off, you know, just to sit around for 5 days and not do anything, you know. So a lot of times when the first game after the All-Star break is a very, very rusty one for a lot of different teams because you only have like one or two practices to get your rhythm back, and guys lose their rhythm throughout the course of that time. So, you know, if you hopefully, you know, you stay in shape a little bit, you know, continue to shoot, you can keep your rhythm.
Second-year forward Reggie Evans of the Sonics is nursing a strained lower back. He's not worried about staying sharp or maintaining a rhythm. He just wants to rest and see how his teammates do on the court.
Yeah, so I go back home and go chill with my folks. That's about it, really. Watch Rashad and Luke, you know, on TV and stuff, you know. So that's about all I'm going to do, just go home and take advantage of being around my family.
Do you get anxious not playing for a few days over the All-Star break, or are you glad to have the time off?
I'm glad to have the time off. You know, you play this many games so many days. Growing up, you know, I never played basketball as much as I did since I came here because I never played AAU ball, you know, like a lot of these guys, so I'm happy to get a break.
Ultimately, the All-Star break is a player's chance to do whatever he needs to do the most, whether that's resting, working out, or, in the case of Sonic center Jerome James, pursuing unique spiritual opportunities.
Well, I was thinking I was going to go on one of those four-day Bible retreats. And try to convert some nice young virgins into Buddhism.
Into Buddhism or Buddhism?
Both.
For only a game, I'm John Moe in Seattle.
I'm going to go to a
four-day Bible retreat.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. David Honan, a street entertainer in York, England, may have been more than entertaining in his impersonation of a Formula One car. Dressed in a red Ferrari uniform, running about, holding a steering wheel, Mr. York was apprehended by police, who held him for 2 hours, then released him with an official caution. They said that Mr. Honan had run out into traffic and claimed they were afraid that he would cause an accident. "It's absolutely ridiculous," David Honan said. "I now have a criminal record over something absurd. What's the world coming to if you can get arrested in a shopping precinct for pretending to be a car?"
I run a 600 for my mill. It's never lost yet, and it never will. I race real cool, never take a spill. I'll take on anyone for the thrill.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the Minneapolis-Harlem tilt that changed basketball 57 years ago. But first, the owners and players of the National Hockey League, who found themselves in uncharted territory earlier this week, now apparently have a chance to avoid becoming the first American sports league to lose an entire season because management and labor couldn't agree on a contract. Joining me now to discuss what happens next is Scott Burnside, who covers the National Hockey League for ESPN.com. Scott, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me.
The NHL had claimed that the union was unwilling to understand the league's plight, and the Players Association, for its part, had said that it had never had a partner with which to negotiate. What changed last night?
Well, it's like one of those relationships where you have a terrible fight and you say all kinds of things you don't really mean, and then you wake up in the morning and you realize that probably life is going to be a lot more difficult if you followed through on all the things you said the night before, and this is why they're back together. I mean, that's it's a bit simplified, but I think essentially what's happened here is in the cold light of day, after having canceled the season Wednesday afternoon, I think there have been a lot of reconsideration on both sides of the fence here. I think there were owners who felt that maybe there should have been a deal cut before Wednesday's cancellation. And I know there were a number of players who were angry at how the negotiations went, how the NHLPA handled their end of negotiations. Some felt they'd gone too far, and then others felt that having gone that far, they didn't close a deal and that was a failure on their part. So all in all, they have managed against all odds to agree to meet in New York. And I think there's every opportunity now for a deal to get done. I mean, there seems to be no sense for them to actually meet without coming away with a deal that would see a partial season played and the Stanley Cup awarded, which I think is, if you're a hockey fan, it's good news.
Well, I want to get to that last point that you made a little later. But first of all, the players who, as you say, felt things had gone too far not to get a deal, obviously referring to the salary cap issue. The players had agreed to a salary cap. Is that what made today's meeting even possible?
Well, I think you have to understand that when the players, in their final proposal on Monday night into Tuesday, when they put a salary cap on the table, it marked a seminal change in their philosophical approach to this dispute. They had said all along they would never accept a salary cap of any kind. When the deal fell apart, there was a lot of anger for the players who said, well, why did we wait so long to put the cap on the table? What if we'd done this in November? Why couldn't we have had a deal? And I think that is probably, there is no doubt there's a lot of fractious behavior now within the 730 members of the National Hockey League Players Association, and I think that is part of what's driven today's meeting.
On the other side of the fence, Gary Bettman had said during the week, nobody should be worried about our franchises surviving the work stoppage. I wonder how many owners called him and said, hey, pal, I'm worried. Get back to the table.
Well, and that's the other thing, is that if there isn't unanimity of voice in 730 players, there is also a divisive framework within the 30 owners. I mean, there are owners who felt that $42.5 million was far too much. I talked to a former team president who said that he felt that some owners were happy to see the season canceled because they felt 42.5 had gone over the line. You have much more moderate owners who want to play the season. They want to compete for the Stanley Cup. So you do have a discrepancy within that group as well. So there's no doubt that different factions were at work in the hours, I would say almost immediately after the season was canceled Wednesday, working to try and drive this forward. I think the fact you've got Mario Lemieux and Wayne Gretzky, who are expected to be at the bargaining table now, that is a huge element because they carry so much respect with them on both sides of the fence. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, why did it take so long? I mean, only the NHL could cancel their season and then continue to negotiate. But, you know, and in terms of credibility, is this a real shot? I mean, I guess you could argue that this is a league that had very little credibility to begin with, given how the negotiations had gone.
Assuming that there will be a National Hockey League season of some kind this year, which is really the only reason for everybody to get back together at this point, will fans accept it as a legitimate season? I mean, we're talking about a regular season of what, 20 games?
Yeah, well, I think it'll be a 28-game slate and a full four-round playoff year. Now, that's the other option that could come up at discussions. I mean, I don't think anyone knows clearly, you know, whether it's for certain that we'll play this year. I think the odds are that we will, but there is some possibility that they could discuss a deal that would take effect next season and say, let's try and get our house in order during the summer. So, but let's assume that we see a 28-game schedule this year. There will be, I think, legitimate questions about the legitimacy of the season. The Stanley Cup will be awarded. It is, I think, rightfully regarded as the most difficult trophy in pro sport to win, given the regular season, 82 games plus four rounds of playoffs. This will change that, although I hearken back to 1994-95 when the NHL was in a 103-day lockout. They played a 48-game schedule when they managed to get a deal before the deadline, but the New Jersey Devils won their first of three Stanley Cups. Very few people think of that now as the tainted Stanley Cup. I mean, it's a team that was full measure for its victory that year and really has proven to be one of the top franchises in the NHL. So in time, perhaps, it will fade. I think in the coming weeks and months, certainly there will be a lot of asterisks attached to the season. But I think over time, people will forget this nasty business that we're involved in right now.
Scott Burnside writes about the National Hockey League for ESPN. He joined me on the phone from his home in Atlanta. Scott, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
Fifty-seven years ago today, the Lakers, then of Minneapolis, met the Harlem Globetrotters for a game of basketball in Chicago. It was not just any basketball game. It was, as far as many of those playing, most of those watching, and all of those promoting the affair were concerned, the basketball championship of the world. In a new book entitled Tricksters in the Madhouse, John Christgau tells the story of that remarkable game and the era in which it took place. John Christgau joins me now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Mr. Christgau, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
People who know the NBA only as today's collection of multimillionaires are going to wonder why a pro team, in this case the Lakers, agreed to play a game against the Globetrotters. What, if anything, did the Lakers have to gain?
Well, they probably had little to gain. It was a game that was arranged between Max Winter, who was the general manager of the Lakers, and Abe Saperstein, his good friend, who was the owner of the Globetrotters. And the two of them kind of had this side bet to the effect, my team's better than yours. And so they made arrangements to meet in Chicago Stadium. And for both teams, it was a game that they weren't necessarily ranking at the same level of importance as the other games they played. The Lakers were in a battle for the National Basketball League championship, and the Globetrotters played sometimes two times a day. So for them, it was just an extra game that they weren't all that excited about playing.
You write very early in the book that neither Max Winter, the general manager of the Lakers, nor Abe Saperstein, the owner of the Globetrotters, quote, appeared to understand the racial implications of the game. How was that possible? The Lakers were all white, the Globetrotters were all black.
I think it's something that you have to credit to the obtuseness of basketball team ownership and basketball obsession. One gets so engrossed by the game, the demands of the game, and particularly the managerial demands of the game, that you hardly see the game in the larger context in which it exists. And in this case, neither one seemed to appreciate at the time that it was anything other than a colossal matchup between two very good teams. It's also probably true that they didn't have the perspective that we have today, or even that I got and developed as I began to read newspaper articles that were a reflection of what was happening not just in Chicago and not just with these two teams, but throughout the country. And so that gives us a somewhat different perspective than those two gentlemen had at the time.
1948 was, of course, only 1 year after Jackie Robinson integrated Major League Baseball, and basketball was pretty much white guys playing against white guys and black guys playing on the road.
Exactly what it was. And people who came into Chicago Stadium to look at this game couldn't help at one level appreciate the fact that this was a basketball matchup between an all-black team and an all-white team that reflected the racial divisions in our society. But that wasn't what was paramount in their mind. What was first in their mind, because that's how it was sold in the newspapers of the time, including the black newspapers, it was sold as a colossal basketball matchup. And the issues of race were not discussed, at least in the press. And if people began to think about that, it was only as an afterthought and in the months that passed after the game.
Once the game itself got underway, it became evident that neither team was going to entirely overwhelm the other. But though they were in a battle, the Globetrotters worked some of their comedy routines into the contest. Was that part of the deal that Mr. Saperstein and Mr. Winter made?
I don't think it was a deal that they made, but I think it may well have been something that the Globetrotters felt they could spontaneously resort to. It was also something that they did tactically. At one point, they went into their pinwheel offense, in which Goose Tatum posted himself at a high post, and the four remaining Globetrotters kept spinning around him. And that was a routine, or a ream, as they called them, that they often resorted to in games. And that pinwheel would get tighter and tighter and tighter, circling players around Goose Tatum. And when the Lakers thought they were watching just another ream, and their role when a ream was indulged in by the Globetrotters, their role was as stooges, just to stand back and watch. Well, George Mikan stepped back, entertained as much as any of the 18,000 fans, and he was just kind of watching with a wry smile on his face. This is great entertainment. And suddenly, out of the corner of his eye, he sees Irmer Robinson, one of the guards for the Globetrotters, cut for the basket. The Lakers realize they've been put to sleep, so to speak, and a quick pass to Robinson. He gets a layup. And at that point, the Lakers say, no more. We're not going to be fooled again. And so from then on, it was just straight-up hard basketball with no entertaining ream.
You mentioned George Mikan, probably the best-known of the Lakers in 1948 and the first of basketball's dominant big men. Would it be an exaggeration to say Mikan was responsible for making pro basketball seem legitimate to the game's first generation of fans?
Absolutely. Most basketball historians credit him with being the most outstanding player of the first 50 years of basketball. Mikan was 6 feet 10 inches and weighed 250 or 260. So I was a kid in Minneapolis at the time, a 14-year-old gym rat. And everybody in Minneapolis loved Big George Mikan because he was bringing to the city of Minneapolis for the first time recognition for a professional team. We never had any major league professional team in Minneapolis.
Without question, the hero of the game was Marcus Haynes, who played a fair portion of it with what turned out to be a broken back. You write that if Haynes' injury had forced him out of the game, the Globetrotters would have been finished. Why was that?
It's because he was such a spark plug on the fast break offense that they decided to go at halftime. At halftime, they were trailing by 9 points. They had been playing a very slow-paced game, which was characteristic of basketball at the time, which had, quote, a postman and standing guards. And the game was very deliberate and slow and methodical. The Globetrotters felt that they could run because they played every night. They felt that they could push the Lakers at a fast pace and catch up with them. So at halftime, they decided they were going to run. And the spark plug for that were Irmer Robinson, Willie King, and Marcus Haynes. And Haynes was the passer. He was the one who knew how to dish passes off at the end of the fast breaks. He had a few very good moves of his own that he knew how to execute. So he was really the core of that fast break offense. So if Haynes goes out, obviously they lose a central part of their offensive strength for the second half of the game, and that would have been critical.
You say at one point of the Globetrotters that the game was, quote, a battle for equality as much as anything else. To what extent did the game against the Lakers advance the cause of equality in basketball, in sports, and beyond?
I think probably in several ways. At the level of basketball and in sports in general, bigots and racists in this country were maintaining that blacks did not have the athleticism and skills to compete with white athletes, particularly at the level of professional basketball. And after this game, it was clear that they were surely as gifted as any white athletes in the country, and perhaps in this game, more gifted. They could do everything that white athletes could do, notwithstanding what bigots were insisting, which was that blacks weren't coachable, blacks couldn't jump, blacks lacked all of the necessary teamwork skills. All of that was demolished by this game. So in the level of competition in sports and basketball, this game was an eye-opener. Some people say, well, John, why do you insist on that when black teams had been beating very good white teams for years prior to this? And I think the answer to that is that they hadn't been doing it in Chicago Stadium, the madhouse on Madison, as they called it. They hadn't been doing it there except on this occasion in February of 1948 in front of 18,000 people. So it became center stage for a colossal matchup that couldn't help but have, over time, racial implications.
John Christgau is the author of Tricksters in the Madhouse, Lakers versus Globetrotters, 1948, published by the University of Nebraska Press. The PBS documentary based on the game will begin airing on Thursday. Mr. Christgau joined me from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. I've enjoyed it. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org.
Yes, that was that cat, all right.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, CabotCheese.com, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, dogs watch sleds race, offer commentary. But first, joining me for a look at the week's news is our analyst Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Just when it seemed the National Hockey League season and perhaps the league itself was doomed, enough people involved with the hitherto disastrous National Hockey League collective bargaining process decided to think clearly and to return to the table today. There is reportedly an agreement in principle which would allow 28 regular season games and then a four-round playoff season for the Stanley Cup. Will battered National Hockey League fans take any solace in this?
I feel really bad about this because I feel really bad for all the people to whom hockey really matters. Because of all the sports fans in America, hockey matters more to the people who really care about hockey than any other sport matters to the people who really care about it.
A complicated sentence, yeah. But a dead certainty. I agree. Mr. NASCAR,
hey!
Join me for a moment, please, to comment upon the pole positions for this weekend's Daytona 500 and perhaps who has the good setup.
They all have the good setup right now. You only have the good setup after the race is over and you've like thrown a fuel rod through your Framagant. But you want a prediction there? I'm predicting because I like the way he's been running. I think Kurt Busch from the number 13 position in the number 97 Ford is going to win this damn auto race.
And you're on the record. Souvenir seekers at the track better have proper ID.
Speaking of Kurt Busch.
At least if they want to buy caps and jackets associated with teams sponsored by breweries or by distilleries. What's the logic here?
I guess if you're going to, because NASCAR expanded its permissible liquor advertisement to include hard liquor this year. Dave Blaney has Jack Daniels. Jim Beam has Robbie Gordon. Kurt Busch is now not merely named himself after a beer, but he'll be advertising Crown Royal. You know, I guess if you're going to throw yourself wholeheartedly into the notion that alcohol and very fast automobiles are a good mix, you should at least make a token gesture to say that it's probably not a good mix for children.
It seems as if the Red Sox may soon bring their winning ways to NASCAR via Roush Racing. Is former Red Sox player and racing enthusiast Mike Greenwell waiting in the wings?
Boy, I hope so, because that would be a lot of fun. Mike's been in the news this week, too, over demanding his MVP award back. But, if there was ever a player I ever knew who was meant to be a NASCAR official, it's got to be Greeny.
Well, you mentioned Mr. Greenwell asking, quote, where's my MVP? He finished second, of course, in the voting in 1988 to Jose Canseco. Canseco recently admitted that he'd taken steroids. Mike wants the trophy. Do you think he has a case?
No, I mean, you know what? He probably does, but, you know, this is not the door that baseball can open. But the one thing that this does is remind us that for all his goofiness, and he was a wonderfully goofy guy, Mike Greenwell was a hell of a major league ball player. He had 325 that year with 22 home runs, 119 RBIs, and 16 stolen bases. He's a lifetime 300 hitter, and he's coaching high school sports back in Florida. Let's get him back in the big time.
That's all right with me. Beyond LaFair Greenwell, would you care to summarize or comment upon Mr. Canseco's alleged tell-all book?
You know, there's a great line from the movie JFK where the Jim Garrison character says, I never understood that just because a woman was a prostitute, she had to have bad eyesight. Just because Jose Canseco is an irredeemable sleazebag doesn't mean he's telling the truth about a bunch of stuff. And lo and behold, and I didn't think this would happen, his book seems to have moved the discussion and the controversy and the quote-unquote scandal to a new level. I still don't know that it's penetrated the public at large as much as some of its loudest tub thumpers do, but this certainly is a different stage in the argument.
Dick Weber, who was Mr. Bowling for a couple of generations of TV viewers, died on Sunday night. He was 75 years old. Among his many distinctions, Mr. Weber was National Bowler of the Year three times. Are you, like me, compelled to admit that you recall vividly watching this guy on TV, bowling show after bowling show?
5 years in Milwaukee, I saw Dick Weber come down on a cloud. Are you kidding? He's the Arnold Palmer of bowling. Mm-hmm. He was the guy who put bowling on TV and kept it there. And yes, there are people, the lights are dimming all over the Waukesha Mixed Singles League tonight, believe me.
Groans and complaints echoed throughout the world of competitive cycling on Wednesday.
And they were nearly audible.
Yes, indeed. As Lance Armstrong announced that he would compete in the Tour de France again this summer. Do you think anybody else is going to show up at the starting line?
I don't know. But I mean, you do have to admire him to an extent to put it on the line again, because whoever beats him finally is going to be a legend down through the history of the sport. The only way Lance Armstrong can do anything different in terms of being a legendary cyclist is to lose this race now.
Reggie Fowler is in the process of buying the Minnesota Vikings, which would make him the first African-American to own a National Football League team. Does this development signal a major change for the better in the NFL?
It is a good thing. I think this is what the people who have been crying for black coaches and black coordinators have been saying, that what you need basically is somebody doing the hiring and firing, who won't be locked into the old boy network. And say what you will about Reggie Fowler, including his resume, he's not locked into the old boy network.
In college basketball, Charlie, a major upset on Thursday night, unranked Virginia Tech beat Duke. Despair in Durham?
A little bit, I think. Duke has been doing it to a large extent with mirrors all year. This really scrambles the tournament picture, because Virginia Tech has now played itself into the tournament, which, of course, will have ripple effects down the line.
And finally, Charlie, lots of NBA players have been involved in lots and lots of lawsuits over the years. But as far as I know, Rasheed Wallace of the Detroit Pistons is the first player to be sued by a guy who tattooed him. Nike is also somehow involved, and it seems that money may be a factor.
And what does the guy suing want, Bill? Wait for it. An arm and a leg! But the interesting thing, and Karen Given, our formidable associate producer, pointed this out, the tattoo is copied from some Egyptian thing that I'm sure he found in the encyclopedia. Are we going to see, like, class action lawsuits by the descendants of Ramesses IV, who are all now working for financial services in Cairo?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Arm and a leg. Get it? Get it? Huh?
See, it's funny
get
because...
It? It's the second time. It's funny because it's an arm.
Two weeks from today, more than 80 mushers and their dogs will set off on a journey of more than 1,000 miles. Along the way, those brave enough to compete in the Iditarod will face exhaustion, danger, and bitter cold. Last week in Lowell, a community north of Boston, nearly 60 mushers took on a similar challenge, sort of. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
You might think that in the moments before a national championship, the person in charge would be a little busy. But an hour before push-off of the 5th annual Human Dog Sled National Championships, Lowell Assistant City Manager T.J. McCarthy sits at a conference table on the second floor of City Hall, staring at the March Madness-style bracket he's set up for the evening's event. Maybe McCarthy can stay so calm because this competition is the national championship in name only. Or maybe it's because in the last 5 years he's made a science out of running this event. He even knows what to do if it doesn't snow.
We usually find it. We go to skating rinks. Maybe go up to the ski area and hire a couple trucks to go up there and truck it in. Yeah, that's why Public Works Commissioner, the first year we did this, he said, boy, he says, now I've seen it all. He goes, usually yelling at me for not getting the snow off the street. Now you're telling me to put it on the street. So it is pretty funny. Yeah.
There's no lack of snow this time around. A blizzard in January took care of that. And taking the dogs out of the dog sled competition avoided another obstacle.
As a matter of fact, in the first year, I got a phone call one day from Peter in the way you say it here, Peter, up here in Boston. And they said Peter in Washington. We're like, Peter who?
That would be People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, calling to offer the city of Lowell an award for their animal-free event. A yellow bobcat stands by for last-minute repairs to this year's track. As promised, the Public Works Commissioner has filled the street in front of City Hall with snow and surrounded the course with bright lights and plenty of stadium seating. Two dog sleds, straight from the L.L. Bean catalog, are set up for the six-person teams, with designated positions for one musher, one passenger, and over-the-shoulder straps for four runners. McCarthy finishes a last-minute inspection of the track and is pleased.
The track is approximately 70 yards long, and it's about heck, 25 feet wide, and they go down about 60 yards, and the first sled to completely across the finish line is the winner, and they come back to the thunderous 32 tomorrow.
That's awesome. Now, you know when dogs do this, they go thousands of miles. Are
yes.
humans just lazy?
No, I don't know. I that's a question to ponder. I guess I don't know.
So far, the only actual dog in attendance is Yeti, an appropriately named Black Lab German Shepherd mix. According to his handler, JD, Yeti just couldn't stay away.
You know, he has to get his, you know, piece of the pie, so.
Is he just watching tonight?
Yeah, he's just a spectator. He's trying to give some coaching to the fledgling dog sledders, so. He's a long-time sledder himself, so.
Really?
You know,
he is?
Want to say hi, Yeti?
Well, be sure to give them all good advice, Yeti.
As the sun goes down, so do the temperatures, much to the dismay of the ladies of Dom Polski, a Polish national club. They crowd around the warmth of a barrel fire and show off their team spirit.
Go Poodles! Go Poodles!
Go, go, go Poodles!
The Dom Polski Poodles are dressed, appropriately enough, as red and white poodles. Their elaborate costumes include short frilly skirts, tails, and dog collars, but it's the white earmuffs that really make the outfit. Treasurer Karen Finch says warm ears are just one of the improvements over last year's design.
We have different costumes this year, bigger and better. We went third place last year.
You guys handmade your skirts.
Yeah, we showing a little leg this year.
And why poodles?
Why not? We won last year. We're trying to win again.
We're going to win again.
We're going to win.
The winners of the costume contest get $1,000 in gift certificates. The winners of the real competition get, well, bragging rights mostly, which they flaunt at every opportunity.
Are you guys the champs?
Yes, we are.
Mike Power is the head coach of the Lowell Nor'easter semi-pro football team. He led his team to the New England Football League AAA championship this season and is hoping to lead them to their third human dog sled national championship as well. Power and quarterback John Spidell say they're getting a little tired of seeing all the loot go to the costume competitors. So why didn't they join the fun and try to sweep this year's competition?
We were thinking about like serious cheerleading uniforms earlier today.
Cheerleading uniforms.
And win.
Gilligan's Island, stuff like that we thought about. But it's very hard to get football players to dress up like women.
Welcome to Winterfest. All five, ready for the dog sleds? Let's hear it.
The stands are packed for the opening run. Lowell's hometown boxing champ, Irish Mickey Ward, is on hand to judge the costume contest, and a curious group of gentlemen covered in tinfoil are getting ready to hit the track.
Who are you guys?
We're foiled again. This is our leader, Joe Parisi.
Actually, it's Justin Parisi, if you want to be accurate. You might not have to be on a first-name basis to pull a dog sled, but if you want to pull for Foiled Again, you have to work for a local environmental engineering firm and cover as much of your body in tinfoil as possible. Justin Parisi explains the strategy.
Actually, it does keep us warm.
Oh, good.
It does attract attention.
Yes, it does.
It is original, and you can cover almost anything in it. Spoken by a true engineer.
Parisi has covered a 3-foot-long helicopter in tinfoil and attached it to a hard hat. As the teams dutifully approach the starting line, Parisi parades in front of the spectators, allowing his tinfoil helicopter to twinkle under the full glare of the stadium lights. After an entire minute of showboating, he takes his position on the team. Foiled Again doesn't have much to fear in their first heat. They're up against a group of bankers who get tangled up halfway through the race. Still, Foiled Again will be back for the Thunderous 32 tomorrow. The Middlesex Sheriff's Office sled dogs don't have to wait to find out if they'll make the Thunderous 32. They made it to the Final Four last year, which gave them a bye in the first round. If that doesn't give Rick Maloney and his team enough confidence, just factor in what they do for a living.
Special Operations Unit, SWAT team.
So you guys have to be in shape for a living.
Oh, we try. We try.
Do you do any special training for this event?
None. None at all.
Do you even break a sweat out there?
It's too cold to sweat. Too cold to sweat, but we work up a good thirst anyway.
Like all perennial powerhouses, the sled dogs have built up a rivalry, strangely enough, against the local gas company.
That's our competition right there. That's Keyspan. That's the enemy. That's the enemy right there.
Keyspan lost to the sled dogs in the quarterfinals last year. Brian Doe says the team has been doing everything they can to even the score.
Do you guys train?
Each and every day.
Every day.
For at least a month, yeah. We pull sleds weighing in excess of like 300-400 pounds. Yeah, we take this very serious. Oh, sure. These are conditioned athletes, these gentlemen right here.
Hopefully, all that training will come in handy, especially when you consider what's at stake.
We have servicemen waiting at each one of their doorsteps. So if they cross the line before us, we're going to shut all their gas off at their house.
Have they counter-threaded?
Oh, absolutely they have. They've said that if anything happens to their house, that they're going to get in their black uniforms, their guns, and they're going to put shock grenades in each one of our cars. Because that's a SWAT team. But we're not afraid.
In the end, the Lowell Nor'easters sealed their dynasty with a three-peat. The Shocking Electrics won the costume contest, and the grudge match between the Sheriff's Office sled dogs and Keyspan once again saw the SWAT team victorious. However, in the past week, there have been no reports of unexplained gas outages, and none of the SWAT team's shock grenades have gone missing. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Okay, we're gonna get going. Thank you very much. Have a good time.
So messed up. I want you here. In my room. I want you here. Now we're gonna be face to face.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Margaret Lee at KQED in San Francisco and from John Funhouse Marston. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or view photos of human dog sledders, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Seattle Supersonic non-all-star Antonio Daniels, who offers the following weekend advice to Only a Game listeners.
Two words, going home.
Okay, Antonio, then what?
I'm going to give you one word, relax.
Yeah, that sounds good. Maybe just go home and stretch out and watch an NHL game. Maybe not. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.